Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Following the budget battle in Bridgeport for the past couple of weeks, and it's really started to heat up in this past week especially. And this morning, there's now another development in the story. The latest here, Bridgeport Mayor Joe Ganim is offering to increase the education spending by $500,000 in the upcoming fiscal year. The city council was looking to see that exact increase in their budget adjustments by adding the money and cutting five Ganim appointees. So this morning, I want to talk about what's going on in Bridgeport? What's the very latest? What is the city council going to do next? And for that, we have city council president here, ID Nieves. ID, thank you so much for coming on. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me this morning. I just want to say that I think it was a multiple chain of events that led to this. I entrusted my committee co-chairs and the committee to handle the budget, which I believe they did a great job. And just like in every budget year, we have, you know, we may have disagreements with the administration that we try to work out, unfortunately, due to the timing of the budget cycle and deadlines. And, you know, personalities and things took a turn into a completely different way this time around. And there is still, you know, an opportunity to go back and renegotiate some items. But right now, you know, we did put in two resolutions to kind of have that ability to present the budget to the mayor. And that's where we are at right now for Monday's meeting. We have a resolution to impose the statute, Connecticut State Statute 99-7-191B, which would allow the council to vote by a two-thirds vote to amend the budget deadline. Now, we need the legal opinion on that, which we haven't received yet from the city attorney's office. But I'm anticipating that there will be some type of opinion coming out by Monday. So right now, that's where we are. The mayor and I have spoken, and we're going to have another conversation probably again today to discuss next steps.
Okay, so I think that you've given the umbrella of what's gone on. I think, you know, and that's what it has seemed like in the news. It seems like the budget overall, there were really no complaints. But the big thing was, you know what, we've got some people in the Ganim administration that don't really do a lot in their roles. So maybe we could use their money and give it back to the education system, which I think that's okay. That makes sense. What do you think, though, happened? Because where there's outrage maybe from other city council members and certainly from the city is they feel like Mayor Ganim blocked the opportunity for a special meeting to happen so that this could be addressed. And I think that's the point of contention here this morning, ID, is that people feel like the city council did not get their day to really talk about the budget that they wanted to see happen. And it just moved forward. Is Mayor Ganim required to call a special meeting for the budget?
Per the charter, yes, he is. Procedurally, it states in the charter that we are supposed to send him a letter for the meeting. But in practice, in precedence and practice, the committee has been passing this amended budget. The mayor calls for the special meeting. We've scheduled the date of two possible special meetings in the event we can't vote out the budget or it's not done in time before the deadline so we can meet our charter obligations. In this time, the mayor did not sign the summonses. We did reach out to the FOIC commission to see, because the meeting was noticed, if we could proceed. That is why on Tuesday we received on Monday, myself and two other committee members, the co-chairs of the budget committee, attempted to move forward with the meeting, and then the city attorney's office issued an opinion without contacting me at all that day or previously on Friday to talk about the impasse that the mayor and the council were at that time. So he sent a notice out to the city clerk's office with his opinion stating that the meeting would be legal if we held it on Tuesday. The city clerk then canceled the meeting. The mayor never signed off on the summonses to host the meeting per the FOSC commission because the meeting was noticed and was on our calendar and then went out publicly. It is a public meeting, but after speaking with the budget committee chairs, we decided not to have the meeting and then just do a caucus to discuss this issue. And that is why on Wednesday we submitted the resolution to amend the the deadline date for the charter
to extend
to use the state statute. To extend it.
Idy Nieves is here, and she is the city council president in the city of Bridgeport. And just to go back, Idy, I'm sure I sound like a crazy person, but it was a little confusing. So per the charter, Mayor Ganim needed to call a special meeting. However, procedurally, it sounds like there was supposed to be a letter that was sent to him. But, like, who dropped the ball here is what I'm getting at. Was it Mayor Ganim that he just did not give that opportunity for a special meeting?
Well, this is the this is the one time that he and the time that I've been serving on the council that he wanted a letter. He's saying that a letter was required through the city attorney's office. Like I said, his staffers were there, his mayor's aide who sat in on all of the budget meetings. He knew what the schedule looked like. We have not done anything differently than we've done previously in the past, in the last 6 years that I've served on the council. It has always been noted that we put in dates in our schedule for a special meeting so we can vote out this budget. And yes, procedurally we are, but there is precedence where we did ask, if you remember, back when we had the Columbus Day statue issue, for a meeting, and 14 council members did sign up on it. And it didn't happen. But because this was of the essence of time, there was precedence, but he did not sign off on it. He had the opportunity and he didn't. And maybe it's just so it doesn't. So we don't go down that road of debating the five positions and doing the veto. Those are all the things that have come to the budget committee's mind. But at this time, that's why we're moving forward with the special resolution to adopt it on Monday to make sure we can do this. But again, this is the first time that we've had this situation. So moving forward, we will make sure that we send a letter on every time so we can keep it documented. And then it doesn't really mean anything if we send a letter because we've already seen that the city attorney's office will write an opinion on the behest of the mayor to make sure that it is written in his favor so he's not compelled.
Okay.
To call those type of special meetings.
We're chatting this morning. Very glad to have her on the show. City Council President Idy Nieves with the city of Bridgeport. So, Idy, my last question for you. I know you you have a lot of important things to do, and I appreciate you being here. So Mayor Ganim is now saying he will increase the education spending by $500,000. That's what the city council was looking for in their adjustments for the budget. Where is that coming from? Is he saying he's willing to cut those appointees, which is what the council suggested? Or where is the $500,000 coming from?
At this time, in our last conversation, if these two resolutions that we passed are not viable, then the mayor's budget does go into effect. And what would happen is, per the charter, his budget went into effect on Tuesday. He would have to submit a budget transfer from OPM. So he would have to find somewhere in the budget, in his budget, where this money would come from. It'd probably come out of the general fund, and he'd ask for a transfer from the general fund in the event that he, because in his budget the positions are not cut, he's not required to cut them once it passes. The vacancies that are there will stay vacant. The positions that are filled will stay filled. And then he will do a budget transfer, and that will require a two-thirds vote of the council to transfer those funds so the BOE can receive those dollars.
So when you say the general fund ID, give me an idea. What does that cover? Is the general fund just like if something pops up, almost like a rainy day fund? What does that mean for Bridgeport residents? Okay.
Yeah, it's almost a rainy day fund, and it's our general fund where we keep the money there. It's like a bank account. Let's say like it's the city's bank account, savings account. And
right.
Usually we attempt to make sure that the general fund, and that's where the surplus lies when we talk about the surplus in the city, that when we say we have a $2 million surplus, it stays in the general fund. And any funds that were not spent within the fiscal year go back into the general fund. And that's what you hear at the end of the year. Bridgeport or any municipality or town has a surplus that goes into their general fund. And then next year, that is where usually you try and keep the same number or it increases or decreases depending on what the budget looks like.
So, Idy, here's my last question for you. Do you think that's a good idea to take money from the general fund versus cutting people who are in the Ghanem administration, who council members have come out and said these are major supporters of the Ghanem administration and Mayor Ghanem?
I think the story of this being a political attack on individuals, I think that has compounded the issue with the budget. When we do the budget, we don't name names. It is just positions. There are vacancies in some of these same positions for a very long time because they're unaffiliated positions. So I think there is one of two, I think we saw it in the press, that would be impacted, that people would know who that position is, and that is the deputy CAO's office. But this is not, the intention was not to, so to speak, you know, do this to attack individuals who have political ties either to the party or within the community. That is not the intention. Through the charter, it does say that the city council budget committee has the ability to add or delete any item within the city budget. So it can be any item. We could delete the chief of staff if they wanted to delete the chief of staff. We could delete a maintainer, which has happened. We can add a maintainer, which is one of the things that this budget had. We had added maintainers, positions for public facilities. We had added our positions for the legislative office. But more so, the five positions that we added were positions. We added a nurse, a maintainer three for our sanitation department, a maintainer for our parks department, and two other positions. And they won for zoning. And these were positions that were going to impact quality of life issues as our constituents were requesting. And we were trying to fill those public facilities positions that were outward facing into the community. So when you talk about the five positions that we are decreasing, we also increased by five positions for public service.
Right. So I guess my question is, do you think at this point it's worth diving into the general fund? Because it sounds like the reason they wanted to cut those positions was to make available more funds for education. And since that's not going to happen, yes, do you think it's worth going into the general fund?
If the mayor feels that he wants to go into the general fund, there is the ability. And I don't think that the council will go against it in the event that his budget is the budget that stands. He will have to, you know, this will play out that he will keep his position. He'll get a little bit of political heat. I think he'll get a little press on this. And then I think the community's main concern is that the Board of Ed received the $500,000. And in no way, I believe, the council is against increasing that $500,000. That's why they took this action. To the latter, again, like I said, the mayor would have to give his explanation, and he would have to live with those positions himself.
City Council President Idy Nieves, we really appreciate you coming on this morning, and we'll look and see what happens next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Talk to you soon.
What's happening in Washington and how it affects you? Melissa in the Morning welcomes Congressman Jim Himes to WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Welcome back to the show, Congressman Himes. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing great. Thank you.
So I had a couple things I wanted to talk about. I know you and I want to dive into the aid that President Biden had announced he wanted for Ukraine, and I do want to talk about that. But before we do, this was something I saw overnight. Of course, I did check the sources. I've seen it on a couple different spots. So, of course, the first one that was sent to me was through Fox News. So I wanted to double check that and look at it. And I'm seeing it also in the New York Post and also in the Washington Post as well. There are claims by a Florida Republican lawmaker that dozens of boxes of baby formula were found at a processing facility at the U.S.-Mexico border. Now, of course, you're no stranger to what's going on in the news. We've been dealing with baby formula shortages across the country since the start of the pandemic, but it's gotten much worse since February. And I'm wondering the truth behind this. I mean, is there a stockpile of baby formula being held at the border?
Melissa, I'm not aware of that story, so I want to be very careful of commenting on it. Is it possible? I suppose so. Do we import formula from Mexico? I don't know the answer to that question, but it is not unusual for goods to be inspected, to be held in, bonded warehouses. So, what I would be skeptical of is that there's some, conspiracy or whatever to prevent American people from getting baby formula. So, again, I don't want to comment on it because I haven't seen the story, but I'll tell you what, I will look into it, and if there's anything to it, we can talk about it next Friday.
Okay. No, I appreciate it. Like I said, this was something I learned overnight, and I just wanted to know if there was any truth behind it, because I agree with you. I don't want there to be conspiracy theories. I don't want there to be, if we don't have the facts in front of me, I don't want to report something that I don't know if that is in fact true. So I appreciate you looking into that. So let's switch gears. I do want to talk a little bit about the money that was proposed by the president. This was a couple of weeks ago. Billions of dollars in aid to Ukraine. $800 million of it, I believe, is in military assistance, and the other $500 for humanitarian aid. First of all, could we dive into it a little bit and just talk a little more about this price tag and what it's going to mean?
Yeah, so just to bring you up to date, on Monday of this week, the House, in a very, very strong bipartisan vote, I think something like 370 members of both parties voted in favor, actually of a package that's considerably larger than what you were talking about. The package in its total amount is almost $40 billion, and roughly $15 billion of that $40 billion is military equipment. The Ukrainians, as you know, have been fighting ferociously, but they are almost out of the artillery, the helicopters, all of the stuff that is allowing them to hold off and in many cases push back the Russians. So about half of that, $15 billion or so, is in military, direct military equipment, military aid. About 14-ish billion of that is money that is going to go into Europe to address the millions of refugees that have left Ukraine. So you can imagine what that's like in Poland and Romania and other countries that are on the border there. These are not hugely wealthy countries, right? And now they've got millions of people who need to be fed, housed, and kept safe and healthy. So about half that bill is designed to help with these millions and millions of displaced people in Ukraine. And then lastly, there's a piece of this, about $4 or $5 billion, which is for global food aid. And why is that important? As you know, Melissa, Ukraine and Russia are both very, very substantial exporters of wheat, of corn, of sunflower oil, things that are really important to the global supply chain. And we already see the increase in prices on food in our grocery stores. When you start talking about countries like Egypt that import most of their wheat, other countries in Africa and Asia, if bread prices go up substantially, food prices go up substantially, you're looking at unrest in the street. So there's about $5 billion in the bill to address that. It is not yet passed the Senate, so we're not talking about a final version here, right, because the Senate will get its say. But it looks like it's got pretty good and strong bipartisan support in the Senate as well.
I'm curious, like with something like that, I understand obviously supporting like the food needs, but are there other countries that are also stepping up and putting money towards that?
They are in a big way. In fact, some countries on a relative basis, right, we're an awful lot bigger economy than Norway and Sweden, right? On a relative basis, they're stepping up in a humanitarian way, percentage-wise, as bigger than we are. Only the United States can provide the kinds of weaponry as quickly as we have been doing it. So, yes, most of the rest of the world, but certainly the rest of Europe other countries. I happened to be in a meeting with the King of Jordan earlier this week, and they're providing humanitarian aid as well. So yeah, it's a global effort that is being made here.
We're chatting with Congressman Himes this morning. So, Congressman Himes, there were a couple of pieces of the new aid that have been in question. One was talking about possible more COVID relief, which I don't know how you feel about that, but I know not everybody feels like we really need to continue dumping money into COVID relief. And then there was another piece that was questioning the protection of refugees, Afghanistan refugees here in the United States. Could you address either of those?
Sure. So the COVID relief money, the administration has asked for, something like an additional $10 billion for domestic COVID stuff. That's not in the Ukraine bill. So it wasn't part of the discussion about what we were talking about before. It's a separate bill. And the money there, the idea for the money there is that, as people know, they have been able to get vaccines and usually testing for free. That's because, a couple of years ago, the government made the decision that we weren't going to ask people to pay for a lot of the things that reduce the death rate. What we're seeing now is that vaccine stocks are lower. Testing sites are being closed down. And so the scientists are telling us, first of all, and, I'll be the first to say that I'm in a much happier place now that, mask restrictions and other restrictions are gone. But we're still losing, last time I checked, Melissa, we're still losing, a couple hundred Americans every single day to this thing. And just yesterday we passed a milestone where we lost 1 million Americans. I mean, Melissa, if you and I had said 3 years ago that there was going to be something happen that was going to kill 1 million Americans, we would have looked at each other like we were crazy. This remains a serious thing, even though an awful lot of people are, quote unquote, over it. So that's a conversation for a different day because there's no particular bill on the floor right now.
Oh,
but
okay.
Yes, there is a request for additional money. With respect to Afghanistan, I don't want to give you bad information, but I'm not aware of there being Afghanistan refugee money in the Ukraine bill.
Okay.
It's quite possible that some of that $14 billion is going to be used for general refugee operations around the world, but most of it is targeted at providing aid to the millions of Ukrainians who are now outside of their country.
Okay. Well, Congressman Himes, I really appreciate it. And certainly if you have the time to look into the baby formula shortage and the border and all of that, I would love to get feedback on that. That would be great.
Yeah, I sure will. I sure will. It's obviously a very serious issue for a lot of people. We'll talk more about that down the road.
Yeah, and I'd also love to talk, and I don't know if this is something that's being discussed at the national level, but we've had pediatricians on the show, and they said, why can't we widen the market? Why are we only relying on four manufacturers in the United States, three or four? And then if one has to shut down, like Abbott, where they've got to do this major recall, we end up in this situation, in the future again. It was a good question she had asked, and I thought, well, maybe I'll ask Congressman Himes about that.
So. Yeah. Well, we can talk more about, that's a super interesting topic, Melissa, because, we have a free market economy, right? The government doesn't go in and say, hey, we're going to have six manufacturers of baby formula.
Right.
That's sort of the old Soviet-style industrial management.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what we have. We have a free market. And free markets usually work pretty well, except in some cases where they don't, right? And, I mean, not only are we seeing it maybe with baby formula, but you remember how hard it was to get masks 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's because we import them all from China. And maybe we do need to do some thinking about that. Like, should the government step in and say, hey, maybe we should make some of this stuff at home? So super interesting topic. But, we have a free market economy, so the government doesn't generally tell, the market how many manufacturers and that sort of thing there should be.
Yeah. No, it's a good topic. I think we should talk about it. Congressman Himes, always love having you on the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Melissa. Bye-bye.
This is Marcia Proto, the executive director of the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce Incorporated. And we've had Marcia on a bunch of times to talk about workforce numbers, you know, getting nurses more attracted to the field. But then when we get them attracted to the field, where is the hospital room and the space for them to get the degrees they need and get out and be able to help our state out? And joining us back this morning, of course, no more fitting time to have her than during Nurses Week. Marcia is here. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa, and good morning, listeners. It's an exciting time for nursing and healthcare and education, as I just listened to all the resources hopefully channeling into the greater Bridgeport area for their school systems.
So tell us a little bit. It sounds like you may have some developments to share with us this morning. What's going on?
We do, Melissa. So last time we spoke was after the governor's workforce council and the governor had a press conference and announced dollars would be allocated in his budget for nursing education, nursing workforce development. Well, just last week, we're excited to say that the legislature approved $35 million for healthcare workforce funding, and those dollars are going to be going for faculty and scholarships for nursing, healthcare, and behavioral health workforce development and education. So we are thrilled. This is actually a groundbreaking investment in nursing and healthcare by our state in really over 30 years that I've been involved in healthcare. So very exciting time.
So let's break down all of those facets you just talked about. Let's start with scholarships. Are these high schooler
Sure.
scholarships to go to college? Are these what kind of scholarships are we talking about?
That's a great question. So right now, many of our high schools are working with our community colleges to create seamless pathways into healthcare, allied health, and nursing roles. And some of the community colleges are actually offering, I think it's up to 27 college credits that a high school student could attain during their sophomore, junior year in high school, and they can seamlessly transition into the final year of associate study at the community college. So lots of resources are going into that type of seamless education. And so they're also looking for scholarships for individuals going into hard-to-fill roles. There are criteria on this dollar, on these dollars, because it is from the federal American Rescue Plan Act a bundle. So it's the ARPA money. And so it ties directly into individuals and organizations that have been impacted by COVID. There are some parameters around that money.
That makes sense. Do we know, Marcia, when yes. these will be available, made available to students?
So related to the scholarships, I'm not fully aware. In addition to the scholarships to go to school, there's also a loan forgiveness program that was approved as well. That's an additional $11 million. And so that will also be supporting individuals to pay back loans that they've incurred while going to school to attain their degree. Or for somebody who may have exhausted their student loans and wants to go into a high demand job, they'll be able to get some dollars to reimburse them for their education.
We're talking this morning to Marcia Proto, who's the executive director of the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce here in Connecticut, and amazing money that is coming into our state. It's going to really help boost our numbers for nurses, which is what we need. And we love our nurses. My gosh, do we need them more than ever. And another thing that you had mentioned in there was faculty numbers. So to refresh for people, Marcia, why do we need more faculty? Because what you had explained, I think, in the past to me was that it's hard to find specific it's hard to find people who are going to leave the big hospitals, for example, with the money that they make there to become like a professor of nursing. Correct? Am I right on that?
Melissa, you're right on target. We did talk about that last time. And the challenge is in healthcare, especially in nursing, you do need to attain some academic credentials, a master's degree, to become a full-time faculty or part-time, what we call clinical faculty. And so when you look at what education has to offer for salaries and compensation for a master's degree, a nurse to work in an academic institution, it's only two-thirds of what they could make with their master's degree if they were in a practice setting, whether it be a hospital, surgery center, long-term care, home care. So it really is that special individual who wants to, number one, educate the future nurses of Connecticut, but number two, has that passion for education. It's just like in our school systems. Our school systems for high school, they need master's degrees, but if they use their master's degree in the discipline outside of education, they may be paid more because of that academic level.
Mm-hmm.
And what we really talked about last time as well, sometimes the salaries are based on a 10-month contract because many faculty at the college university systems don't work during the summer. So you could say, gee, maybe that nurse would take another role during the summer, and so their overall annual compensation could be equal to what they made in practice. But as we know, especially during teachers during the past 3 years in COVID, trying to balance online education, on-ground education, morph your curriculum, it's been much, much more than a full-time job. And I'm sure all the educators listening today can say they probably worked four times as hard over the past 3 years than they ever had in the past to meet the educational goal.
Mm-hmm, definitely. It's Nurses Week, and we are chatting this morning with a morning show friend. Marcia Proto is back, the executive director of the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce. So we were talking about new grants that are coming to the state of Connecticut. This is through the American Rescue Plan, Marcia. And one of the things I wanted to know about was space. So when I say space, I know you and I, when the first time you and I talked on the air, we had talked about some of the problems we're seeing in Connecticut, why our numbers are not at a healthy place for nurses. And I remember you saying that even if we had big classes of nurses, yes, one of the big things was that we needed faculty to actually do those clinicals and to be able to get them their credits they need. But the other thing was that we lacked space for this the clinical work to be done. So are we looking at potential spaces to be able to do that? Is this money going to help with that? Can we get an update on that?
I would love to share. So the exciting news is we just finished a study and asked all of our programs in the state of Connecticut, colleges, universities that have registered nurse programs to share information about their student demographics, their capacity and graduation rates. So great news. Last year, we were actually able to increase, Melissa, the number of seats that we offer of 180 extra seats. So now we're taking 2,992 students, so almost 3,000 students.
Wow.
And over the past 2 years, we've actually been able to increase our seats over 300. So that's about 6%. So as you're alluding to, our schools are beginning to take more students. The crazy thing is, last year, even during COVID, our qualified applicants for the entire state for registered nurse programs, so these are qualified applicants, grew to 13,175 students, which is crazy because in the year past, we had 12,000 qualified applicants. So that's almost a 9% increase. So again, more people want to go in.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to accommodated all of our schools, more than 425 students throughout the sophomore, junior, senior years in the baccalaureate programs or the two-year programs at our associate degrees. So we are getting there. What's a good thing is some of our schools are partnering with our hospitals and practice settings. Yale really is a front runner. They were able to work with four of our colleges and universities to say, we will provide you space for your student clinical experiences, and we will provide you the master's level nurses to be the on-site clinical faculty. So next year, I think they're looking at maybe a group of 30 at each of these four college universities. So that's another 120 students that we're getting in. Clearly, by no means, not enough to meet our qualified students who want to become nurses and will not meet the demand of what our healthcare facilities need, but it's a great start. Hartford Healthcare System is also doing some innovative programming.
So with
our organization, oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, with the grants, the money, everything that's coming now. I know you're. This is just kind of a step in the right direction. But do we have any kind of projections, even if it's ballpark, Marcia? Any kind of projections as to how many nurses we would add to the workforce through these initiatives?
We're hoping through the state initiative, when I had put together the proposal in December and sent it to the Office of Workforce Strategy, which actually I believe was the foundation for the $35 million because we added a few things. Mm-hmm. We were looking to expand our student capacity by a little over 1,000 students over a three-year period.
Okay.
So that will support faculty acquisition for the schools and universities. It will support the student going through their education program with some wraparound services. It would support employers and practice settings to identify people who could act as clinical faculty so we could expand that. And then it would also support the transition to practice for the students. As you know, education lags practice. You know, our practice settings, with all the new research and new technology and new protocol and therapies to care for patients, is running so quickly. Well, our education system, you know, and our curriculum, we always will lag behind, just like any other discipline is going to lag behind. So when our students graduate, they usually engage in what's called a residency program, mm-hmm. which is really an intense onboarding to make sure they have the competencies that are required within the practice settings, whether it's orthopedics or oncology or medical surgical nursing. So it will also support that transition to practice. So they'll stay, because as you know, Melissa, our attrition rates within our healthcare facilities is just out of control at this time.
Mm-hmm. No question. Well, Marcia, I guess the last question I have for today is, if somebody's listening and they are interested in any facet of the nursing world, whether that's being a faculty member or maybe going back to school, wanting to become a nurse, they want to go down this road, what would you suggest? What's their next step?
They should call the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce, 203-691-5013, or they can search us on the web. We have a wonderful website. We even have a site called the CT Nursing Guide or ConnecticutNursingGuide.com, listing all the programs and education levels from LPN to doctoral. So if any nurse is listening and trying to find out, gee, what are the baccalaureate or master's programs available in the state, they can do a one-stop shop, gain some information, and then our contact information is all throughout the site. We'd love to talk to them to help steer them into the right track or discipline that meets their needs, even if they don't want to become faculty but are looking for another role. So we're always here to support our nurses and our healthcare stakeholders in really creating a robust and sustainable nursing workforce in Connecticut.
Marcia Proto, we really appreciate the work that you do, Executive Director of the CT Center for Nursing Workforce. Thanks for popping on the show this morning.
Thanks. And one shout out, Happy Nurses Week to your mother.
Oh, thank you. That's so sweet. Yes, to all the nurses out there. Yeah, Claude, you're included. That's awesome. Thank you, Marcia. I appreciate that.
All right.
You're so sweet.
Thanks. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
You too. Talk to you soon. There is a big open house happening Saturday, May 14th at the Stratford EMS, and it's a great opportunity for you to learn a little bit more about EMS work, meet the Stratford volunteers and the workers there at the Stratford Emergency Medical Services Building, which is at 2717 Main Street. And this morning, we're talking to the director of EMS Stratford, that is Mike Louise here. Good morning, Mike. Thanks for being here. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. I think this is an amazing opportunity, and I'm so glad to talk about EMS workers. We talk often to law enforcement and firefighters here on the show, but not enough to our first responders. And I'm curious, tell us, for people who aren't familiar, what does sort of the daily life look like for an EMS worker?
So basically, an EMS worker comes in. They will check all of their gear. They'll make sure that they have all of their safety equipment, like radios, portable radios, and things like that. And they'll get their truck ready. You know, the truck, the vehicle, the ambulance, it is their office for the day. So once they have all that set, they will usually try to go grab something to eat if they haven't brought anything. And then it's call after call after call for the rest of the day. There's very little downtime. There's a whole ton of documentation that gets done, and they may or may not be in some really not so nice environments. They may be working around a car that's flipped over, or they could just be in your living room with your family, sitting on the couch with you, trying to find out, you know, what's going on today and how they can help you with it. But mm-hmm. it's all about providing really good, high-quality patient care.
What are you required to have under your belt in order to become an EMS worker?
So there's different levels, and at the EMT level, you're required to complete about 180 hours of training, as well as, you know, have some other certifications like CPR, like our National Emergency Management or National Incident Management System certifications from FEMA. To become a paramedic, it's almost 2 years of training, and there's probably five or six at least other certifications that you will acquire during that time: advanced cardiac life support, pediatric advanced life support, all that kind of stuff, as well as once you get your license, you then have to do what's called precepting, which is working alongside another paramedic for a period of time until everybody feels comfortable that you've got it down, and then the hospital can sign you off that you're cleared to work independently.
Mike Louise is here, who is the director of EMS Stratford, and there's going to be an open house tomorrow. What do you find, in your professional opinion, Mike, what is one of the harder parts of the job? I know you had given two very different scenarios, like a crash scene, for example, where you're with police, fire officials. It's a big scene usually, versus when you go to a home, like the example you gave, you know, if somebody had some kind of an episode or they fell, it's usually EMS that's going to come and help and be in that situation. Which do you find is harder, or are they equally very difficult?
Well, I would say, generally speaking, they can be equally as difficult. One requires a lot more technical skill, hands-on technical skill, usually under the trauma side of things. And the other one requires a lot more, probably, intellectual skill, where I'm thinking about what is going on inside the body, using diagnostic tools, and trying to help the patient, you know, from a, you know, if they're having a heart attack or something like that, trying to help them more from a medication point of view or an EKG point of view. You know, it's both of them have their benefits as far as ease, but both of them can also be very complicated.
And, Mike, in recent months, we've heard of different communities where they've updated radios at police departments, for example, or they've updated trucks at fire stations. And I'm curious, do you feel that Stratford has gone through any changes of recent? Have they updated radios or updated trucks or added any to the fleet or anything like that that's worth note?
We haven't updated our trucks as far as the numbers in a few years now, but we have all of our radio systems have been updated and upgraded. All of our we have mobile data terminals in our vehicles. Those have been updated and upgraded. Our vehicles are actually Wi-Fi hotspots so that we can send EKGs and other documentation back and forth to the hospital. That has been updated. And this week we just rolled out a new technology called Triage, which the hospital is providing. But what it allows us to do is it allows us to communicate directly to the hospital electronically via an app. So we don't necessarily have to rely on the radios as much if we don't want to, or we have some need to go directly with the doctor at the hospital or something like that. And it can provide telemedicine capabilities in the near future. So we're pretty excited about that.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were in on Triage. That was going to be my next question, because I know we had the not the creators, but the people rolling it out at Hartford Healthcare on the show earlier this week, because it launched Wednesday. And I was wondering, you know, for EMS workers who are in towns and cities, not necessarily with the hospital, if they were going to get access to it. So that's very cool. So Stratford EMS does have access to Triage.
Yes, we do.
That's very neat. So let's talk about tomorrow, this open house opportunity. This is an annual event. What can people expect?
So the open house is at 2712 Main Street. Basically, what we do is we just open our doors to the public. We will have, activities and crafts and things like that for young people. We will have lots and lots of information for our adults. There will be meet and greets. There will be an opportunity to see our capabilities, see our vehicles, see some of the technologies that we're working on. If they want a tour of the headquarters, they can have that. And we will likely even have a couple of capabilities demonstrations on site as well. It's a great time. There'll be music. Usually the stormtroopers show up at some point, or somebody from Star Wars shows up. And it's just a really great time to get together with your local EMS and reflect on what we do, how we do it, and get some information on who we are. It's been 2 years that we've been working through COVID, so we haven't been able to do this. So it'd be nice to reconnect with the people that we serve.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And what time does this start, Mike? 11 o'clock, right?
Starts at 11 o'clock, runs till about 4. And there's also going to be giveaways. So come on down.
It's going to be a great event. And again, you really get to appreciate and understand the work that our EMS workers go through on a daily basis. Mike Louise, we so appreciate you being here. Thank you so much. Again, the open house tomorrow at 2717 Main Street. That's the Stratford EMS right there in Stratford from 11 to 4. Thank you, Mike, for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And thank you for the work that you do, too. You and your team. We really appreciate it. This is sponsored this morning by Staples. Staples morning by